The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Fibre, Ireland's fastest growing broadband provider. The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Fibre. Sky's broadband tech team ensure your broadband runs at its optimum speed. It's all part of the service.
Well, throughout Donald Trump's campaign for the White House, and more recently after events in Charlottesville, the so-called alternative right, the alt-right, has shot into a position in the mainstream. My next guest has been investigating the movement for the last few years and has written about it in her book, Kill All Normies, The Online Culture Wars for Tumblr and 4chan to the Alt-Right and Trump. The author's name is Angela Nagle. She joins me in studio now to talk about this and other stories. Good morning, Angela. Nice to see you.
Morning.
What's a normie? It's a kill all normies. Let's get that out of the way first.
Yeah, well, it's not a suggestion on my part. It's just a particular phrase that they use. Normies refers to people from outside of the internet subcultures where the alt-right kind of developed. So normies would be essentially people who have not been red-pilled yet, people who have not understood the things that interest the alt-right.
The alt-right, you know, even watching events recently in the States, seems to be fall under, you know, it's a massive umbrella for a bunch of disparate types and groups. Is there a dictionary definition yet, or is it too early to say?
Yeah, that's the complicated thing, because right now what's happening is anyone who said anything positive or even sort of ambiguous about the alt-right is now sort of getting dragged up on Twitter and so on.
Yeah.
But the problem is that the definition has been all over the place. I mean, so for example, most people I talk to, if you say alt-right, they think of basically everything to the right of Trump, you know what I mean? Which is actually a lot of you know, politics.
Yeah.
Other people would use a much stricter definition, and I've tended to use the very strict definition. That would be a group of anti-establishment right-wingers who are, putting race back into the center of politics, who assert that race is real and it's fundamental to civilization and so on, and they actively advocate for essentially the resegregation of America. So they want a white ethnostate, and you know, they say this. I mean, they're very open about it. You don't have to go digging. So that is the strict definition of the alt-right, you know. And then around them you have all these kind of other little groups and subcultures and stuff. So one of the things that really shot them to fame, along with the Trump phenomena, was the fact that they had this kind of online army of kind of trolls and anonymous people on different forums that kind of, the phrase they used was like, memed the alt-right into existence. So in other words, you know, they had this online army essentially doing this kind of propaganda for them.
Mm-hmm. And memes being photographs with expressions, just for people who don't know, with words and expressions written on them, and they're meant to be comedic, but actually can be quite cruel.
Yeah. So the idea is basically any kind of typically text and image that's designed to be shared and adapted. So you can change the text, but you know, the meme is the idea of the image sort of spreads. You know,
you've described it perfectly for I think people will totally get a handle on that now. And with that in mind, let's talk about their emergence as a group. Its emergence as a group, the alt-right. Where had they been hiding? How do they suddenly come up as an expression, if you like, as soon as Trump started looking like a winner? Because it looks overnight, it can't possibly have been, was it?
No, definitely not. I mean, Richard Spencer, for example, who's the most prominent spokesperson of the alt-right, he's very much made himself the prominent spokesperson of it, in a way by being strict about the definition and thus kind of excluding all the various groups around them.
And cutting across to remind people that he was the man who was filmed shouting Heil Trump when he got elected. Okay, back to Richard Spencer.
That's right. So Richard Spencer would openly advocate for a white ethnostate and stuff like that. He's very, very open and clear about his goals and his politics, while a lot of the people around the alt-right in the broader kind of online milieu in particular like to be very evasive, and they like to use irony and playfulness to kind of put journalists on the back foot, and kind of, you know, so they'll flirt with, you know, far right imagery, but then they'll make fun of, you know, journalists and people who try to write about them who point this out, you know. So that's kind of what they do. But Spencer, for example, has been around for a while. I mean, he's about 40 now, and he, you know, wrote for American Conservative, which is an anti-establishment American right-wing magazine that opposed the Iraq War. It's associated with Pat Buchanan and people like that. And then he got kicked out of there for being too extreme. And he ended up in this kind of, basically a little kind of an ecosystem of anti-establishment right online magazines and, you know, publishers and forums that were essentially kind of breaking every taboo and following arguments as far as they would go, pushing ideas as far as they would go, and kind of, you know, I guess being irreverent around taboos to the point where there's kind of nothing they wouldn't say. And where they ended up was really saying, essentially, the conservative establishment in America cannot address the problems we have. The problems we have to do with the race.
This brings us to the idea that the Republican Party, for this crowd you're describing, as we know it, the Republican Party was not conservative enough anymore, and that they had to go further right. You could arguably bring it back to the Tea Party as a sort of as the genesis of something, although the Tea Party now looks benign, I think, beside these guys. Let's bring onto the stage then the guy that most people recognise, name-wise at least, is Steve Bannon, who was heading up Breitbart, which seemed to have been almost a mouthpiece at the propaganda wing of the alt-right. Would that be fair to say? I mean, he seems to have done, the book that I'm reading, The Devil's Bargain, about him, would suggest that he's realised there was an army of dispossessed, disenfranchised, mostly men, playing computer games. I mean, that sounds trite, but I think there's more to it than it might first seem.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, for younger people who are now maybe, say, in their early 20s, the big moment, one of the big moments in the kind of online culture wars was Gamergate, which was...
Yeah, what is that? Or what was that?
So Gamergate was an online war that got, you know, so huge. I mean, you could never get to the end of the opinion pieces written about it and the various claims made on all sides. But in short, it was a culture war about video games and the idea that video games, you know, were being on the one hand critiqued by feminists for having, you know, violent and macho and sexist content.
Yes.
And then there was the pro Gamergate people who fought back and who said they wanted to protect their games from being kind of destroyed by political correctness and stuff like that. Now, the people who ended up in that Gamergate kind of world defending games were, some of them were what, you know, some people have used the term cultural libertarians. So their view was just that culture should be allowed to
roam free.
Exactly. And it shouldn't be under this kind of, you know, the constraints of being, having the correct politics or whatever.
Yeah. There should be no moral police on the computer games.
Sure. But then within that world, I mean, this is always the problem with the alt-right, that, you know, people can't sort of believe that a group that has such extreme views has managed to get to this point.
But yes,
the problem is that they're always hiding among all these other groups of people. And so in the past, when people would say, oh, Gamergaters are Nazis, because here is, you know, an account of somebody who's got a, you know, like a swastika logo on their account who's pro-Gamergate, you know, a lot of people thought, yeah, but come on, it's video games. Maybe they just like their video games, you know. So in among the Gamergaters were everyone from cultural libertarians, people who are just gaming fans who aren't that political, right over to, you know, on 4chan, for example, which is a kind of image messaging board where, you know, that has been very central to the rise of the alt-right online, certainly, you know, a place where they often strategize and things like that. You know, so it brought in something like 4chan, which is a very geeky sort of countercultural, almost, you know, hacker kind of space.
Kind of like comic book guy in The Simpsons. Him multiplied by a million and multiplied by all these guys who weren't dealing with what we call now mainstream media or mainstream politics. But they were all bubbling under with these opinions. And that was harnessed by the likes of Breitbart, Steve Bannon, who then latched himself on to first Sarah Palin, as it happens, but then he threw his dice in with his lot in with Donald Trump. How did the alt-right, the gamers, these dispossessed fellas who are kind of misogynistic and sexist and angry and violent and anti-Semitic and anti-everyone who isn't white, how did they manage to ride and surf that wave and get their man elected?
Yeah.
Is it, well, do you know, or is it possible to tell?
Well, you see, I mean, the best way to describe it is, like, you know, there was this online world of kind of cross-pollinating forums and subcultures. And, you know, even within that, people were moving kind of around from one to the other. So how I started looking at all of this was, it started with my interest in a very militant style of anti-feminist online politics. A lot of the people who started off having a critique of feminism ended up going very far to the right and ended up being interested in the question of race. And so, you know, I guess all I could say is, you know, Bannon has been around a lot longer than a lot of these young guys who, you know, are now, you know, have been associating themselves with the alt-right in the last couple of months, probably even in most cases. But I suppose you could say the establishment conservative kind of world has fallen apart a little bit, and in the vacuum, this stuff has emerged,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's perfectly pitched. I see exactly where you're coming from. The typical alt-right man seems to be student-y, which is mean to students, but you know there's always some idiot in students' union looking for attention.
Yeah.
But you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Student-y idiot, and I still know some of them who never grew up. Taboo breaking, as far as they're concerned. Shouty. Polemicky, and ultimately kind of not as well informed as they'd like to think. Does that illustrate, would that be a fair illustration of the alt-right typical, or is that a soppy Guardian reading, soft left RTE type person's view of the alt-right, which is exactly why Donald Trump got elected, because people like us are talking about people like them with this sniffy tone?
Okay, well, the first thing I would say is that, you know, Trump got elected because basically America, you know, it's a two-party system and you kind of have to vote for one of them. And, you know, before the elections, I distinctly remember the tone, even among, you know, Republican voters, was very much, I don't really like either of them, but I guess I'll vote for the Republican one because I'm not going to vote for Hillary. So, you know, there has been a little bit of a rewriting of history where because Trump is always called populist, we think of him as being popular, as if this was some kind of big wave of popularity for this new kind of right. Trump is extremely unpopular, and he's actually at an all-time low in terms of popularity. The most popular figure now in American politics, according to the polls, is Bernie Sanders, who's you know, a Jewish social democrat.
Septuagenarian.
Yeah.
Yeah, nowhere near power at the moment,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, so I think it's important to remember that, and also to remember that most of the people who voted for Trump have never heard of 4chan, you know, don't know anything about the alt-right, are just regular people who kind of are somewhere on the center right, and he was the candidate, so they voted for him. So I think it's important to remember, like, this isn't, you know, it's not like the alt-right has captured, like, you know, masses of the population.
No, but what it has done, hasn't it, Angela, it has caught the imagination of people. And when you look at Charlottesville and you look at the Trump language of the wall, and you look at the attitude, you know, the rudeness of the press conference, not you, shush, you, stop, no, you know, it's bombastic. And it's and I think it possibly enables the heretofore hidden forces to come out of the shadows. Did you ever think in your life that you'd see neo-Nazis marching in a university town in America? We're just short of the sheets and a pair of scissors. I mean, it is extraordinary. So they have caught something, and they obviously feel, as I say, enabled to come out of the shadows because of who's in the White House.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, you know, there's always been a far right, you know, like, you know, even if you look at it's, you know, other countries, I mean, the far right groups pop up, you know, every couple of 10, 20 years. Usually they fall apart, but they pop up in another form, but they're always small. And I think the difference here is that, first of all, there's been a conflation of a whole, you know, broad group of kind of anti-PC, young Trumpian right-wingers with the alt-right. And the thing is, you know, nobody wants to be the one to defend the slightly less bad version of the alt-right, okay? So you don't want to be the person who jumps in and says, right, but they're not actually a fascist. But in a way, the exaggeration of, or the conflation of everyone in the Trump camp with the hardcore of the alt-right has actually helped the alt-right in a way, because they've been able to say, look at our numbers, look how big we are.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, how society, using the States as an example, has gone, in the sense that you have people who are, and I'm saying the term because it's become popular, as it is snowflakey, I need my safe space, you can't do that, you bring down that statue, you can't order that food because that offends my world view, can't order that taxi because of the company upsets my ethics. You know, you barely leave the house now if you were that easily offended. Versus the Trumpy person you've been describing. You said that they see Trump, the alt-right, as larger than life version of what they would love to be. Real life troll, trophy wife, she'll hate that, anti-immigration. He is a fantasy for them.
Yeah.
That's really intriguing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, you know, if Trump had just quietly behind the scenes introduced stricter immigration laws and, you know, more deporting of immigrants and so on, I don't think that they would have supported. I don't think they would have supported him the way they did. I think what they loved about him was actually his style, you know, because it was about the fact that he broke the taboos. Like, yeah. Their whole idea is basically that you can't make any headway in politics because there are too many taboos. And their idea is that their goal, rather than trying to get into formal politics, is to move the Overton window to the right, by which they mean the window of acceptable thought in mainstream debate. So their idea is, if you move that over to the right, if you're the kind of the vanguard on the edges and you can move that over to the right, then the political mainstream can talk about things that they wouldn't have talked about
before.
They'll follow.
You said, you say in the book that 2016 may be remembered, obviously looking back last year, as the year the media mainstream's hold over formal politics died.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, you know, in all the time I've been listening to people talking about the mainstream media and the kind of alternative media and media, social media and so on, it's usually been people thinking that it would be that it would benefit the left.
Yes.
So, for example, I use the reference point in the book of the period around Occupy Wall Street and the Arab Spring, when there was a huge amount of huge outpouring of, you know, sentiment about the idea that technology and, you know, social media was going to kind of change the world for the better, essentially, and it was going to allow all these, anti-establishment kind of groups to emerge. And of course, it did do that, but not the kind that those that Occupy Wall Street had
in
mind.
How's that working out for you, Dr. Frankenstein?
And that's the thing. I mean, you know, online, you can say anything, because if you're in an anonymous forum, you know, I mean, you can say whatever you like. And the thing is, you know, as much as people may not like political correctness, and, you know, political correctness is a kind of way in which we're negotiating the boundaries of polite thought and so on. And sometimes it can get things wrong, and there's a constant debate over it. But I'm convinced that the reason there's a constant debate over it, even though it's effectively just a type of manners in a way, is that it really is about the society collectively deciding what our boundaries are, what our kind of values are, and what our taboos are going to be. You know, and I'm sort of, I would take the view, kind of coming from Freud, that you know, taboos are part of civilization, that you kind of have to have taboos in order to you know, restrain people's sort of worst impulses. And the thing is, you know, we're renegotiating a kind of contemporary society in which, you know, men and women share the workplace completely, and in which, you know, it's increasingly pluralistic and so on. So yeah, the you know, political correctness can definitely be you know, annoying, and sometimes, you know, it bothers
overbearing.
People.
I mean, I think what we've lost sight of as a generation is moderation. I think we've lost sight of moderation. You are either a complete dinosaur who doesn't understand the world, or you're Trumpy and bombastic. There's very little move for you to go, do you know what? I get the political correct thing, but that thing you just did there, that's probably just a step too far. That moderation sense, I think people have lost slightly the run of themselves all over the place.
Yeah, and also, you know, the mainstream media thing is also about the collapse of the mainstream in general. I mean, you know, if you exist in an online world now, like if you're on Twitter all the time, you know, you have a standard. You probably have standards of, in terms of, let's call it political correctness, that would be totally alien to the vast majority of people. You know what I mean? Like, and so you have, instead of having like a mainstream sort of media, like public arena, yes, right? Instead of having a public arena where ideas are bashed out and everyone is kind of more or less on the same page. Like, it's not that long ago since, you know, everyone watched the same TV shows, everyone read the same newspapers. You know, now you can exist in an online world where you don't have to ever have any contact with mainstream society, you know? And that goes for, you know, that is like why the right also developed in a particular way. And what it means is that you now have groups of people who not only can't speak to each other, but want each other killed, you know? It's very hard to imagine how, you know, you can bridge divides, and how you can have a kind of a mainstream conversation about something when that mainstream is not really there in the way that it once was.
It's curiouser and curiouser, the world, there's no doubt about it. And I think your book will offer people some class of guide to the madness of it all. The book is called Kill All Normies, The Online Culture Wars from Tumblr and 4chan to the Alt-Right and Trump. Angela Nagle, thanks so much for shooting the breeze with us this morning. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.